Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We are here with five-time primetime Emmy nominee BJ Novak. He's made his feature directorial debut on Focus Features and Blumhouse's Vengeance. Here he is. It's been said to me by many sources that now more than ever is the hardest time to make a film for theatrical. What's your take on that?
I'm sure you're right. I don't know nearly as much as you do about all those sources and reports. Of course, it seems that way to me too. That's why I went right to Jason Blum, who I had read has a workaround, you know, has his own lane in producing movies where he takes these very small budget bets on first time filmmakers and gives them a lot of control and no money up front, and sees, you know, releases the ones that work and writes off the ones that don't. And, you know, it's a lot more complicated than that, but I did find that to be the system. They did take a bet on me. I met Jason Blum and Cooper Samuelson, his executive, creative executive, and they liked the script. They liked me, and they liked that it was called Vengeance, I'm sure, and they could do it cheaply. And so they said, let's go for it. And that itself is a miracle, but, you know, I think they see themselves as sort of an island of simplicity in the sea of complicated filmmaking. Their business, I'm sure, is way more complicated than it looks, but that is their narrative, and they were true to it. So I'm very lucky that I had the presence of mind to go to them and that they made it work for me.
How long had you been looking to make your feature theatrical debut?
You know, it's what I always wanted to do in my life. When I, you know, I'm one of those kids at that age who, at the age I'm at now, that saw Pulp Fiction in the theater. I feel like it's a cliche to anyone of my generation, but maybe it's new to people and others. But, you know, I saw Pulp Fiction in the theater the night it came out, and I thought, I want to be a filmmaker. You know, I loved movies, but it had never really clicked for me that someone had made a movie until I saw that. Son of a Preacher Man came on, and there was an angle, and I thought, somebody chose this song. Somebody chose that shot. And I know who that guy is because I saw him in Entertainment Weekly. His name is Quentin Tarantino, and he's cool. And I want to do things. That's what I want to do, like a lightning bolt. And so ever since then, I have wanted to do this, but you know, I also didn't over romanticize it. I think that, you know, getting to work on The Office is in many ways a lot more satisfying creatively than, you know, saying action behind a movie camera. So I didn't feel unfulfilled that I was doing other things. I felt completely lucky in other reasons. But yes, it was to be behind a movie camera saying action was the fulfillment of a dream as well.
And how long has Vengeance been with you? You do have the Zen cadence of a public radio announcer.
I don't know if that's a compliment that my voice sounds like a public radio guy. I agree with you, which made me think I was good for the role, and also made me think I definitely have enough of a self-deprecating attitude to not be someone who's casting myself because he wants to look cool. I was like, yeah, you know what? My voice does sound, for better and worse, a little like that. So thank you. What was the exact question though? I got taken by
how long has Vengeance been with you?
Sure. You know, I had the idea sort of the emotional idea of it a long time ago, 2014, 2015, something about someone in sort of a shallow life who is pulled out of his New York or LA bubble with a misunderstanding, you know, a dating misunderstanding with all the texting and the apps. You really don't know who thinks of you as more or vice versa. And that this person would be pulled to a place that he didn't want to go to with this family that thought that they were really serious at this funeral. I knew it was dark, but you know, we had done the British Office adaptation. I loved dark comedy and I'd seen how to make it real and not too bleak. And that idea kind of kept developing and developing when I realized, oh, he'd probably go to a place like Texas. And then I realized, well, it's not just a story about disconnection between people. You know, the whole country is disconnected for kind of the same reasons, that we see each other more as online characters and avatars than we do in terms of actually getting to know how close we are or aren't. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. You have this personal, almost dating comedy on the surface, but then you also have this cultural world that is the setting that is even more dangerous and in terms of misunderstandings.
There's that great moment in the movie where Boyd Holbrook's Ty, mm-hmm. who is the brother of the girl that you knew who's slain, there's an explosion when things, by the way, there's going to be a spoiler alert on this, and this will come out after the movie, but there's this great explosion that you guys have in the parking lot that says everything that's been bubbling up about red and blue state divide. Mm-hmm. And it's about, you came in with a very good attitude of, I want to understand them and I want to, you know, put a nice focus on them. And then you get aggravated. Can mm-hmm. you expound more on that? Because that and the ending are like mind-blowing parts of the film.
That, thank you. That scene was the most exciting surprise for me in terms of what it ended up being and saying. In the script, I thought, well, you know, it's time for people to be stripped bare and really say what they really think or their darkest things that they've been thinking the same time and trying not to think or trying not to say. And yes, my character does lash out at every, you know, furious sentiment he would have about red state people. And I did not hold back. And they didn't either, you know, and as I wrote it, it was sort of like more of a necessary having it out intellectually, politically, you know. In the movie, it was an emotional one. It was a scene of heartbreak. And it ended up, I realized, and Phineas O'Connell, who actually just won the Oscar for a Best Original Song with his sister, Billie Eilish, who he produces music for, wrote the score. And it was his first score, despite that Oscar. And we worked very closely together to figure it out. And he handed in a piece of score that was a very emotional piece of score, not an intellectual one. And Lee Kilton Smith, our executive producer, who is also one of the great acting teachers in Los Angeles, was there on set, really grounding the scene as an emotional one. And I realized watching it that it ended up being the most intimate scene in the movie, because these people were heartbroken that they were saying these things to each other. Mm-hmm. And that after all of this, and that they were enough of a family, in a sense, that they would scream at each other in the parking lot of a Whataburger about what they really thought. That's not how you treat strangers. And it's how you treat people on Twitter, but not emotionally. So it to me, that ended up being the most intimate thing of the movie, that you had earned that fight, that people who wanted to connect ended up in this place. And it ended up being maybe my favorite scene in the film for that reason, that it's not what you expect.
Was the ending always with you, or did you change it at a certain point in time, like closer to production?
That was always how it had to end. And people ask me that reading the script. They were like, are you sure? Really? Huh. But I always knew it had to end that way, because to me, there's an inevitability to the structure of the story, as well as to this character, my character, who thinks he knows it all and has all the answers, mm-hmm. and needs to needs to really become the story and throw that away to become a person. And so I did, and really confront a version of himself that he regrets and he, in a sense, wishes he could have vengeance on. So the emotional logic of the story led to the plot ending.
Okay, because I was going to say what's cool is, practically speaking, the ending, the ending makes sense in regards to its setting, where it is, and how he gets away with it, how your character gets away with it. However, the type of person you are, one wouldn't expect that, but it all made sense. For some reason, it all somehow magically made sense. You know, like, do I think your character has that streak in him? No, but like you said, the emotional logic pays.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I also, you know, I think that the fact that it sort of people are a little rattled by it after, I think is good, because that's also the truth of it, that you can get very caught up. And it also speaks to, you know, this is what has sort of seeped into Ben Manalowitz after, you know, a few weeks in this house. Imagine what it's like after a few generations in a place, how much certain ways of thinking and feeling become you, that have no judgment on your individual character. It's just, we're all a product of our setting and background. So I think that shock to him of sort of being absorbed into that culture and that logic for good as well as bad is what brought him like that. But I think the fact that audiences leave and that's their first question is a good thing, because it means it wasn't neat and it wasn't expected.
And I don't think it was upsetting, by the way. I loved it. It was a wonderful surprise that worked.
Right.
Did you have to fight for the ending? And when I say fight, either with the producers or the studio.
I didn't have to fight with anybody over anything. Yeah. In fact, that made me, you know, that's really the Blumhouse model, and it focuses values. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not a superhero movie. So it's not like, you know, China's going to pull out if you don't, you know, say that, you know, it's, the stakes are what they are. So it was really just, you know, some people saying, are you sure? But that also goes very well to Blumhouse's producing model, which is this almost manipulative, I don't think by design, but for me, it was brilliantly manipulative, in that they would, Cooper Samuelson would always make suggestions, but I never had to take them. So that made me, wait, tell me more. What else? Why? You know, because I want my movie to be as good as possible. Cooper's a smart guy. So it's like, I think this, I would do that. I think this doesn't work. I think this would work better that way. But if he had said, cut this, add that, I'd say, you know, fuck you. I'm a genius. You know, when he says, maybe I'd do that, I'd say, wait, no, tell me more. I'm a first time filmmaker. So no one told me to do anything is the short answer, though.
Tell me about this murderer's row you put together. I mean, you got Phineas as your composer, John Mayer, and Ashton showing up in the film. Were these guys always buds?
Oh, well, John Mayer is such a great sort of outlier in this. John has been a very good friend for years. And, you know, he has this great opening scene sort of riff with me, largely improvised. And just to sort of set up, who is this guy and what world is he in? And I thought, okay, what's me at my feeling coolest, but probably not being that cool? John is a good friend. And over the years, especially when we were younger, us being out at a cool place, thinking we're cool, impressing each other, looking at our phones the whole time, I thought, well, that's both a fun setting and sort of hopefully lovably pathetic, that these guys aren't what they think they are. So, you know, I called them up and I was like, I have this vision for us riffing, you know, here's the vibe, here's the catchphrase we got to keep repeating. And he flew out for it. So that was just a friend call as well as a friend inspiration. And it was actually through him. I was at a party, and not even a party. He was filming this Instagram live show he does called Current Mood. And his guest was Phineas, who I was a fan of. So I went and met Phineas, and I texted my producer, Nikki Kraft.
Fascinating.
What's that?
both of them, him and Billy, very fascinating.
Oh my God, brilliant, brilliant.
And yeah,
he's a movie writer and a cinematic writer. And yeah, to leap ahead to what is so great about him, not only in terms of his talent, but because he's not only a solo artist, but he's also a producer, I think he has a real gift and interest in interpreting the soul of another artist. And I think he treated the film as a solo artist. He's producing the Vengeance album. What's the spirit of Vengeance? What's the feeling of it? And this was such a new blend of tones that I think it needed an original score. All the temp music was to this, to that. You know, it's not quite one genre. So anyway, at John's house, I met Phineas. We bonded over our favorite film scores. And he said, I've always wanted to do a film score. I said, can I send you the script? But then in terms of the cast, it was really just, Cooper had given the script to Issa Rae at a general meeting, and she said, oh, I really like it. And I raced to meet her, and Dove Cameron sent in a tape. You know, Ashton Kutcher was pitched to me by a producer, and I thought, what a brilliant idea. How do I get a meeting with him and just see?
You guys, great work together.
Yeah, thank you.
You get him. I mean, he's organically funny, but you could see he's playing it straight.
Absolutely. And I thought, you know, this is such an amazing opportunity because I know Ashton Kutcher enough to know, even I worked with him on Punk'd 20 years ago, but really just from like interviews he does and stuff. You know, this is a completely serious, intellectual, hypnotically charismatic tech investor. You know, we've never seen that version of him on screen. How do we put that into a character? So, the cast really came from a lot of different places, combination of auditions and, you know, stroke of genius from some producer, et cetera.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So I know you get this question probably all the time, but it's us asking. It's Deadline asking. What will it take for a reboot of The Office to happen? Is that a Greg Daniels decision, or can any one of you can you and Mindy say, you know, we're going to do it, and we're going to drive this train?
I was like, when you said that, I was like, Office reboot or Mindy Kaling? and you worked them both into the question, but of course, I think I don't know contractually, but I know spiritually it's a Greg Daniels thing. Pure Greg Daniels thing. I think everyone knows that he is the person who controls the rights to The Office, spiritually, creatively, the American Office. I don't know the law of it, but we all know that it's a Greg Daniels question.
And then, do you think one will ever happen, or is this kind of like the Deadwood movie, where they immediately, like after Deadwood? And after Deadwood ended, after three seasons, they were like, oh, it's going to be impossible to get them all back together. You know, McShane's over here, and, you know, this one's over, and Timothy is over here. Is it like that with you guys? Like, it would be just this, it would be a seismic force of nature to get everyone back together?
Definitely you wouldn't get everyone back together. I mean,
that
ship I'm sure has sailed. I think it's more about, is there anything to mine creatively that's fresh? I just think it needs to be approached as an artistic decision, not as a financial decision. And I worry that there's so much financial pressure, understandably, to mine this, precious metal in the ground called, The Office reboot or spinoff or whatever. I worry because The Office originally was done for the opposite of money. It looked to all of us in that little writer's room like the most unlucrative, stupid decision we could have ever made, to make a dreary fake documentary set in an office with no shiny stars, no music, no colors practically, definitely no studio audience, that was meant to show the mundanities of a paper company, that let alone all of that, that was a remake of a British show that everyone hated us for even attempting. So, and we just did it because we're like, I really think we can make this funny for ourselves. And as Paul Lieberstein once said in the room, we all know this is getting canceled. Let's just make something so funny that other writers will see it and give us our next job, you know? And that's what made it successful. So I think working the other way, thinking like, how could we get money? It really needs to come from that artistic, this would be a brilliant, beautiful next chapter. And I just worry.
Do you think where we are as a TV audience, when it comes to a sense of humor, do you think it would be harder to continue now? Are there any challenges because of political correctness or anything, or nah? Comedy is comedy and comedy will break through.
I basically believe comedy is comedy and comedy will break through. And I don't think that the audience of The Office has ever not understood the tone or the feeling of The Office. I think that's why it's so popular. But I think, look, I think in general, the people who worry about what comedy will play over worry. I think audiences are very smart and they know the tone. I think people that get offended are often getting offended good for sort of out of a good place. They're getting offended on behalf of people they think might be offended, who in fact are not offended. They have great senses of humor. So I don't know, but I do think in general comedy is comedy. I do think though that the world that The Office was set in was not as high stakes as this one. So I would worry that that it's not funny to have people have different political opinions in the election of 2024. It's not so funny anymore. The things that are in real life, the world is less funny. So I don't know, you know, you don't want Dwight to say the wrong thing because you might really not like Dwight or Angela or Jim or anybody. So I don't know, now it's all hypothetical. Look, basically funny is funny. The question is, could the show be funny? And that should be really the only question anyone asks about trying it again. And I don't know if it could be right now, just because it really takes that inspiration.
Bringing this back to you, your collection of essays, One More Thing. Have you ever thought of adapting that into film? I mean, you have these wonderful stories. You know, your dad was a ghostwriter. Mm-hmm. You know, one of your early comedy bits is Michael Jackson was in you were at a party. You were at an adult party with Michael Jackson.
Oh yeah. That's,
he did not do anything.
Yeah. That's not even a bit. That's not even a bit. That's just the strangest real thing that's ever happened in my life. Yeah.
Yeah. And then yeah,
comedy in my background for sure.
Nancy Reagan, Lee Iacocca in your kitchen.
No, that's an exaggeration. I went to Magic Johnson's house when I was 12. That was pretty mind-blowing. You know, I've definitely had some mind-blowing things, but no, not that. And also, yeah, I mean, George Stephanopoulos, I mean, was at my house once. You know, there are certainly some special people and unusual people in the orbit, but I think growing up, like, it was just such an interesting, I was so lucky in so many obvious ways, but one of the less obvious ones is being sort of connected, but a step away from people like that. My father's job was not to be the star. It was to sort of get in the mind of that person. And I think that's a lesson I took so much from writing, is that, you know, what would Dwight think? How would Michael phrase this? You know, and that's something I tried to do in the movie too, with the Texans, you know, that I didn't grow up with, but, you know, how do you really get in their mind and bring it out like that? So I think ghostwriting is one of the many huge advantages I had. It's not an obvious one, but I think it's maybe the biggest, that I saw my father and respected him for writing as other people.
Now, you told us what inspired you for filmmaking. It was the time when you first saw Pulp Fiction, but getting into comedy, mm-hmm. what, I mean, look, Harvard Lampoon, you're set. That's great. that's fantastic. But what led you down this road? What made you look at the world, you know, with a tilt in your head?
I don't know. I always thought, you know, I'm one of those normal ones. And I honestly think it's alienated me a little bit from the comedy community, you know, because like, you know, the Marc Marons of the world, you know, definitely see comedy is for outsiders. Comedy is for, you know, people that have a broken past and need to heal. And I agree. It feels that way to me too, that the spirit of comedy, I don't know. I just always was an ambitious kid for comedy. I wanted to make the best comedy and work the hardest at comedy. And that's just where I was driven. And I do think I had a wonderful background in childhood. And I always took sort of inspiration from having learned that Jerry Seinfeld said, I'm have no tragedy in my life. I'm normal. And he's so funny and made such a great show. And then I heard that both of his parents are orphans. And I was like, wait, what? Like, and I was like, I don't know what it, maybe there is something in my life or past that did make me pursue comedy of all things with this relentless, relentlessness, you know, instead of like, I don't know, finance or something. Like,
well,
I don't know, maybe there is something about it,
but Michael Jackson,
well, look,
Scattergories.
I did play Scattergories of Michael Jackson, but that's a, isn't that a wonderful thing? Not a, in my case, traumatic thing. In my case,
it was right, not- exactly.
But again, like I don't know. I think I had the most wonderful, lucky childhood, and somehow still wanted to just devote myself obsessively to comedy. And I don't know if it comes from anywhere that I don't know about, or just like, yeah, sometimes some people want to be baseball players, and some people want to be comedy writers.
Is have you performed stand up as we've come out of the pandemic?
Not a long time. No, not since before the pandemic.
Would you ever go back?
Yeah, I think about it. I would like to do something new though. I'd like to have something to say. I feel that the stand up that you knew me as when I started was sort of a different personality and an era, you know. It's like, oh, I'm 25 and 2000, whatever. What's a sort of charming new observation? And that's not who I am or what the world is. So yeah, if I did something on stage, I'd want to really think what's worth saying and what might someone want to hear. And you know, I think, by the way, I don't think I would talk personally about my life. I think for me, what's personal is how I see the world. And do you see it that way too? But I also don't know, only if it's funny. I don't know. I also have been very lucky that I have other outlets for something that I'm burning to experiment with. So, and I respect stand-up so much. I mean, the people that are doing it well today are so good. I think it would be hard to get myself back on stage knowing that, you know, the Mulaney's of the world and the Bill Burr's of the world are out there, at Ali Wong, you know, every day I see a new special that I think, how would I ever get myself back up to that peer group.
BJ Novak, thank you so much.
Thank you for talking. Great conversation.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Crew Call podcast on Deadline. I'm your host, Anthony D'Alessandro. Make sure you subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.